Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Scholars from the Edge of Time, hosted by Nicholas Dyack and Michelle Brittany. Greetings, O scholars. How are you today?
Greetings, Hercules. I'm doing very well. And yourself?
I'm doing very well also. I have to write something that will be on someone's website, so I'm looking forward to that, doing that by this weekend. And then I've decided to work on a book since I've done the whole submitting to anthologies thing. Now I'd like to attempt something bigger. So that's where I am, and it's a good place to be.
Oh, most definitely. And I wish you much success with your book. That's exciting news.
Thank you very much. I know you guys inspired me to write for anthologies, and that turned out to be an exciting two-year adventure. So it seems like the place to go next.
I think that Nicholas and I each want to work towards writing our own books as well. We've just been editing books, so that's kind of our next step too. So we'll be following in your footsteps.
Very, very, very cool. I'll have great company on this adventure then.
Definitely, and us too.
I am looking forward to tonight's show. We have an exciting mummy anthology, and we have a peplum film with muscle men and lions. So who's going to start today, you or Nicholas?
Well, I'll start first, so that way we can end on the muscle men conversation.
Okay.
So, you know, As most people know, I'm into mummies, and I was recommended a book recently on the heels of StokerCon last month, and the anthology is called Spirits Unwrapped, and it is an anthology of 14 short stories featuring mummies. The back cover summary promises the stories will not be a regurgitation of the usual mummy tropes. Instead, these stories can twist tropes of lost love, revenge, the slow-moving revived mummies from Egypt. And, of course, you know, Hercules, we've seen that. You know,
yeah.
And we've read those comics, and we've seen them in cinema. And so often, the tropes become very well-worn.
Mm-hmm.
So in the introduction, Daniel Brem, he's the editor, shares that while he appreciated Boris Karloff's portrayal of the rapt character in The Mummy, most of the cinematic stories he feels lacks elements that work so well in that film. So Brem looked high and low for stories that sated his appetite for good mummy narratives. He came across Private Grave 9, written by Karen Joyce Fuller, sparked his literary pursuit for mummy stories, you know, such as Arthur Conan Doyle's Lot 249, Edgar Allan Poe's Some Words with a Mummy, and many others. And Braun believed that, quote, there remained an untapped potential for mummy beyond Egypt, beyond sentimentality. Where was the monster straddling the distant past, woken in the present, entities that have glimpsed the span between life and death? Where are the mummies of other cultures? And I'll be honest, you know, I've brought these questions up before.
Yes.
And have wondered, you know, where are, you know, the other types of portrayals? You know, so often mummies are portrayed from being from Egypt because those are the most recognizable and probably the most easily accessible because of our kind of experience and understanding, at least at a cursory level, the culture of ancient Egypt. And so I'm thrilled by this book because it does try to challenge some of those tropes. Some are done very, very effectively. Others are fine. None are like an awful story in this collection by any means, but there were definitely standout ones for me. And I thought, time permitting, that I would share two or three. And so what I thought I'd do is give kind of a synopsis, do a short reading, just so that way listeners can get a flavor of the writing, because it's not just one author. It's, you know, two or three different authors. And then talk a little bit about the tropes, to talk about how that story tried to challenge and put a twist on the trope.
That sounds awesome.
So the first story is called Mummy Fever, and it's by David Wellington, and he is a very well-known horror writer. He has written Monster Island, is a zombie story, and he's also written a series of vampire, they're called like, cannot remember, but they're like numbers, like 99 coffins, you know, one nail, and, you know, so there's numbers within the title. But it's a vampire series that's very much in the same vein as Guillermo del Toro's The Strain. So if people haven't had an opportunity or are familiar with David Wellington's writing, he is a very prolific and very wonderful horror writer. So immediately I gravitated towards his story, in part because it is an Egyptian story, but he does play with that lost love trope. And there's a lot of humor and there's a lot of charm to this story. So it is 1923, and Egyptmania is in high gear thanks to Howard Carter's recent discovery of the Boy King's tomb. Mummy Fever opens in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where they capitalize on their displays of authentic mummies with Friday evening parties, minus the bubbly. This was during Prohibition, after all. Because Egyptian motifs influence fashion and culture at large, it wasn't terribly odd to have a gentleman in attendance wearing neatly sundered linen bandages under a natty gray suit and a celluloid collar topped off with a felt trilby hat. Our young protagonist, a Elspeth Rose Lieberman Tubbs, was also in attendance and more appropriately dressed for the times. She is drawn to the chap as he silently reads the hieroglyphs on a display of canoptic jars. He soon settles on one particular jar, picks it up, but here's a brief reading. Before he could reach the door, a venerable mountain of a man stepped into his path, a good 6 feet tall, and of a width that would have made it difficult for him to get through doors. The museum's guard had a pistol on his hip and a complete lack of a smile on his face. "Where do you think you're going with that?" the guard asked, using his chin to indicate the jar. "To my hotel, actually," the rapt gentleman replied. "Though I might stop off and get a proper drink first. Now, if you'll excuse me." "All right, pal, hand it over," the guard said. "Oh, this canoptic jar? But it's my property." "I don't see your name on it," the guard pointed out. "Yes, you do. Right here." The odd fellow pointed at a line of hieroglyphs. "Nefertari Kar Imseti. It couldn't be plainer." This exchange had garnered the attention of the crowd, and now several red-cheeked men came pressing in, some of them pretending to read the pictograms on the jar, some slapping Nefertari Imseti on the back. "He's got you there."
That's very well written.
I love David's writing. So, I just was tickled pink to have his writing in it. So to kind of finish off the plot, this scene actually nurtures a budding friendship between the mummy, who we find out later goes by the name Neville, very English, proper English name, and Elspeth. But it also sets off a chain of comedic events of the odd couple to steal the jar in order to complete Neville's collection of four ancient jars, basically his set of canoptic jars from when he was mummified in ancient times. So, you know, in reading this story, one, it struck me how comedic and humorous and charming the story was. And that is really kind of, you know, different from our normal take of mummy stories. You know, almost always they're set in, you know, in horror, or if they're tend to be on a little more humor side, it's because it's a documentary and, you know, the narrator is making, you know, some sort of, you know, light ha-ha joke or something to something from ancient Egypt times. So, you know, I found the story to be really charming and just kind of an interesting insight into the 1920s when Egypt mania had really reached a fever pitch because, you know, fashions, jewelry, home decor, furniture, even our, you know, grand theaters of the 1920s and 30s were often in this Egyptian motif. So it's kind of nice insight. You know, Wellington really, you know, does a really nice job with setting, you know, the scene, the locale, interjecting those different motifs in kind of an interesting and different way that we often forget how pervasive Egypt mania was in culture at that time. The other thing that he does with the story is that lost love trope. And I know that we've talked about this one before where, you know, one half of the partnership, typically the male, has somehow been become immortal, like drinking an elixir or something of that nature. And he has wandered the earth for millennia in hopes of finding his lost love. And in this story, you know, Neville and Elspeth, they obviously hit it off and they have a nice kind of exchange of banter. They're obviously kind of into each other. But instead of Neville wanting to take those four canoptic jars that represent his immortality, he doesn't want to destroy them. Oh, heck no. He wants to put them in a safety deposit box so that way nobody else can get to them, because he actually rather enjoys living in the modern era. And so it's definitely, you know, Elspeth is kind of thinking, oh, well, obviously he must miss ancient Egypt and wants to travel to the afterlife and, you know, go to those evergreen fields of, you know, of his friends that have, you know, departed, you know, several thousand years ago. But, oh, no. He likes modern life and the conveniences and he's quite happy to be in, you know, in the 1920s. So the other thing that I felt that the story does is that it really challenges that trope of the mummy being a villain. You actually grow real quickly to like this little odd fellow that is actually a mummy, you know, and his laundered linens that are nicely pressed. I could just imagine, and, you know, this proper English accent type of thing. So it's really, really quite cute and endearing, and it's a fun story. And so that's story number one. So the second story is called Fog Marsh. And one of the things that I really appreciated about this book is the fact that it incorporated other types of mummy. It wasn't just Egypt. So in Fog Marsh, it is a story about fog. I say bog bodies because, but they're bog mummies. So in this case, Fog Marsh was written by Rudy Dornman. And he is no stranger to writing about mummies. He's written a number of stories. But Fog Marsh is about an Iron Age Denmark woman who is sacrificed and preserved in a peat bog for many generations. During that time, she experiences the passing years through the eyes of, I would almost say, kind of like the spirit, either the Ka or the Ba, in like you would have in Egyptian mythology. So I kind of see the spirit who is named that one who walks for me in dreams. That's the name of the spirit. Eventually, the woman's body healed over time by being in the peat moss, and she reemerges among the living in the present time and comes across some of the other individuals from her prior life. So I wanted to read an excerpt from that, and I'm intentionally skipping over. I will say that the story starts out about her death scene, and being mindful of perhaps younger readers or those that might be a little on the queasy side, I won't read the first part, but the writer does make an effort to try to explain what that experience might have been like. We've seen images of bog mummies that have the rope around their neck. They've been cut, and the writer uses those images as a way of describing this woman's death. So by this time, she's in the peat bog, and she is recently deceased. While I lie under the bog, that one who walks for me goes out. By starlight, by firelight, my dream self ghost walks, watches, listens. She hears the bedtime chants of lovers, the midnight deliberations of criminals along the road, the stories travelers bring from elsewhere. She hears the language shift, follows its changes. She watches the land transforms as the seasons cycle, watches the people nearby pass from birth to death, from death to decay. The children of our village and their children and theirs. She sees the new fashions they wear, the new tools they carry, sees the village grow to a town, sees nations and religions come and go. She recognizes familiar eyes, hears a laugh we once knew, a certain shrugging sigh echo over generations. And she knows the bog, finds all the objects placed there as offerings in the times before and after my death. Arm rings and finger rings, swords and helmets, dresses and cloaks, food sealed in clay jars and ritual cauldrons shattered to quiet their power. Bodies left here in punishment, lying forever, undecayed between the shore of life and the shore of death. Other bodies like mine sacrificed to keep winter from lingering too long. The spring stirring of seeds in my gut gives the first nudge of spring to the marsh and the land beyond. That porridge contains dozens of plants that aren't normally food, gathered everywhere within a day's journey. They call to their descendants in the world above, the magic of my sacrifice bringing recovery after death, after dead months. And as the world heals itself of winter, my body heals its wounds. Year by year, the knife cuts in my heart stitch up. So that that reads very powerful, isn't it?
Yes, so very powerful.
So the tropes that I felt here, you know, it seems so rare to stray away from the Egyptian mythology. So fog marsh was definitely a breath of fresh air to me because it was unique by rooting the narrative in the Northern European folklore. You know, bog mummies are still mystifying and they're kind of scary because of the violence written on their bodies that have been over the years as the peat bogs are cut and trimmed back as farms take over those peat bogs that are disappearing. But like the Egyptian mummies, I think bog mummies are typically villainous. When I do come across any literature or films that involve a bog mummy, they're invariably, some sort of villainous creature hell-bent on revenge or, you know, maybe their intentions aren't even understood because they're so mystifying. The other thing that I thought was very unique about the story is that it really focused in and featured women at the center of the story. The woman who is sacrificed, obviously she's a woman, but we find that the other people that have been involved with not only her sacrifice, but those individuals that she seeks out in her current life in modern times, those would be the people that are tied to her through that spirit, that one who walks for me in dreams. So there's really a lot of folklore conveyed in this story that is very unique, and definitely the focus on women as powerful, but also, you know, very, I don't want to say typical, but it's obviously quite often women are associated with nature and motherhood and that, you know, cycle of life and death. So this fits very nicely within this anthology of being something new, something different, and, you know, challenging those mummy tropes that we've had in the past and will probably continue to have.
I never even knew that there were bog monster or bog mummy stories. I remember reading about the bog people and how they were sacrificed and so forth. And, you know, people were trying to find like some sort of meaning for their presence and for their sacrifice. And there were a lot of interesting theories, but I didn't know that they had even traveled into fiction. So thank you for opening my eyes to a whole new thing to explore.
Oh, you're so welcome. There's one book that I have read that's a fictional book where there's like two bog mummies, and it's set in, I think, in Ireland and kind of the Scotland area. So that writer does try to kind of give some sort of basis to the bog and the mythology surrounding that, the tie to the earth, like it kind of ties in with like the ley lines and the mysticism related to the ley lines. So mm-hmm. I know that, you know, that story, and then I also think the movie that I'm thinking of also kind of tied with the ley lines and that folklore surrounding that. But there really isn't that many, so definitely nice to see a story such as that in this book. It looks like I have time for one more, so I'm so glad I timed well.
You did.
My last story that I wanted to share is we shift focus and we move to South America. So this story is called In the Ancestor's New House, and it's by Marissa Lingen. Now, this is the story of the ancestor, an Inca mummy, and his caretaker, Ingual. I know I'm slaughtering that name, and I apologize. It's set in South America. It is a time of turmoil and violence between the conquerors and the indigenous people. Hence, Ingual is forced to move the ancestor to a new home. The ancestor and Ingial are able to communicate through a kind of telepathy. So, you know, everything that's going on is, you know, between them through a conversation between the minds. The ancestor is often critical that he is no longer in his temple. And as a result, familiar and expected rituals and traditions have had to be modified for the times or done away with completely. One day, Ingial meets another woman, Lucina, who is running away from being passed to a new master. She is also an indigenous person who has been enslaved for some time. That person died, and now, you know, as is typical of conquered, you know, they're passed along to a new master. She doesn't want that. A friendship forms. And although Lucina has her own beliefs and her own faith. She is respectful and comes to share caregiving duties for the ancestors. So even though she doesn't have like this telepathic communication with the ancestor, she does make a very close connection. An event happens where she has always like not touched the ancestor. Ingyal has always made sure that she's the only one that touches the ancestor. But because these men come by, she has to hide the woman, and so she's got to hide the woman underneath the ancestor in kind of like a, it's kind of sarcophagus. It's hard to picture, so it's kind of hard to explain. But because of that experience, she becomes kind of connected with the ancestor herself. So I thought I'd read one last passage, and let me get to that. So leading up to this passage, the ancestor, for lack of a better words, he does a lot of complaining because he expects a certain station in life, but out of necessity, Ingyal has had to, improvise. And so, he's no longer in his temple. He's in a very modest house. She can't fulfill all of the rituals because it would draw attention to them. And she's doing everything possible to not draw attention to who they are. So this kind of as a way to help pick up where we're at in the story. The ancestor was silent again. The potatoes were done. Ingyal lit the ancestor's portion for him and ate her own, quickly, quietly. They had a routine, the two of them. She had left behind the bodies of the ancestor's other descendants, other servants, and with them the grander rhythms of his court. Ingyal did not even know who called himself the Inca now, nor whether any power remained in him. No one came to consult the ancestor now about matters of state. There was no order wherein the Inca would proceed from ancestor to ancestor, hearing advice and deciding the best course of action. All was chaos. But Ingyal and the ancestor found themselves in a place in the high mountains, away from the poxes and the chaos, where they could have a small garden, and Ingyal could shoo the flies when she was not tending to the house and garden. The ancestor grew restive. Ingyal rested. Ingyal breathed. So,
wow.
Another interesting story. This one I love. It's very quiet, and so it very much mirrors Ingyal's and eventually Lucina's life to be as unnoticed as possible. And I feel like this is such a beautiful story for that. And like the Bog story, it's rare to read a story focused on an Incan mummy. Throughout the story, we get some hints at the rituals and the practices that were probably given to their ancestors. One of the things I read in an interview with the writer Marissa Lingham, where she talks about how the ancestors kind of live or situated between life and death, and so they're often with their ancestors or their descendants. So this kind of is an interesting insight to that practice. And honestly, I couldn't think of any Incan story other than there was the Kojak series back in the 70s, and there was a story of a mummy, but I think it was an Aztec mummy. So it's not Incan, so it's not Incan, but it's Aztec. And there was definitely, that wasn't a quiet story. But
Buffy did one also, I believe. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I believe they did a South American mummy. I don't remember if it was Aztec or Incan.
Oh, yes, that's right. She comes back to life and she's part of like a traveling exhibition. That's right.
Yes, yes.
And she kind of like sucks the life out of different people, I think, or melds with them in some way that causes the people's deaths. I don't remember the exact particulars.
Nor do I, but I remember the museum display, and I remember that Xander got romantically involved with her, but I don't remember very much beyond that. It's been years since I've watched the Buffy.
Yeah, it's been a few for me, too. I think it's been a couple of years since I watched that one. But, yeah, so, you know, there's not that many stories out there, you know, with ink and mummies. I think one of the others might be Ray Bradbury's The Mummies of Gilda Jaro, I think. I think this might be Incan, or if not, they are definitely ancestors that are in a museum. So if people aren't familiar with that story, there's a very good book out there, a picture book to go with the story that Bradbury wrote. And I see that I'm at the halfway mark of the program. So I thought I'd just say again that I've been talking about and reading from Daniel Brehm's edited collection called Spirits Unwrapped. It is available through Amazon or through your favorite book retailer online. So I hope that people take an interest and maybe pick up a copy and read some different mummy stories.
And thank you for bringing this collection to our attention and for picking those gems from the tales contained therein. It was a great selection. It opens up new ways of looking at mummies, and how can that be bad?
Well, thank you so much, Hercules. And with that, I will pass the torch over to my partner in crime here, fellow scholar Nicholas Sayak.
Thank you very much. Would you like to share your contact info now or at the end of the show?
Oh, I can share it at the end of the show.
Okay, awesome. Thanks again, Michelle, and welcome partner in crime, Nicholas Sayak.
Hey, Hercules. Good evening. I hope you're doing excellent over there.
I'm doing as excellent as can be. I hope you're doing as well.
Yeah, not so bad. I had my birthday last weekend, and I had a couple days off work, and today was my first day back to work, and like, oh.
Happy belated birthday.
Oh, thank you. So for today, I'm here to talk about Ursus in the Valley of the Lions.
Dun, dun, dun.
I might be submitting a proposal for a book on cinematic cats. One of the editors of this book, that's just a germ of an idea, had reached out and said, hey, Nick, any possible way that maybe you've got an idea about, you know, cats and peplum films or something? Like, yes, I do. So I have started a kind of just a fact-finding quest to go back and look at, you know, different portrayals of cats. And by cats, I don't just mean the domesticated small cats, but, you know, lions and tigers and panthers and stuff in old peplum films. And just seeing, you know, is there an essay actually there? So we'll see, you know, if something actually comes of that. But it does give me an excuse to watch a peplum film I have not seen before. And I figured, you know, if you're going to go all out with cats and peplum films, you may also start with the big daddy of them all, which is Ursus the Valley of Lions. So this is actually the first Ursus film I've seen. And of course, you know, for these old peplum films, you know, it doesn't have to be an Ursus. It could be a Hercules or I miss this, but you get the idea. It's my first Ed Fury film, first Ursus film, so didn't know what I was getting into. So off the dome, quick plot synopsis is Ursus starts off as a little baby. You know, his mom and dad, you know, are like a king and queen, and of course their kingdom is being overran by barbarians led by the evil Ayok, and of course he kills them. And they're like, no, we gotta protect the kids, get them out of the town. And so they do. And, you know, through happenstance, the baby Ursus gets abandoned in the wilderness by a horse and raised by lions. So that's his genesis story in this, raised by lions. And of course, you know, years go by, he becomes a strong man. He's a young adult with, despite being in the wilderness, he's got the most well-coiffed hair. what can I say? But he comes across a slave trader who has a wagon full of women, and they've fallen into a pit. And of course, since he's a really strong guy, it's no problem. He just jumps in the pit and lifts that wagon out, and everyone's like, ooh, ah. And so, how can I repay you, says the slave trader guy. He's like, I will pick one of your ladies. Yoink! And so he takes a lady for himself. Her name is Anya. And of course, the slave trader's like, no, you can't take my slave. I'm going to sell her. And so what Ursus gives to him instead is his pendant, you know, his royal pendant that ties him to the unnamed city that he is the son of the king and queen who have been murdered. But he doesn't know any of that. To him, he doesn't even know what a pendant is. Take it. So the merchant does, and, you know, he goes off to sell his ladies at the market. And of course, you know, he has a pendant, which attracts the attention of other folks. Wait a second, that pendant looks familiar. Why? That's the royal pendant. Oh, my God, Ursus must still be alive. And so that kind of sets the plot truly in motion. The evil king, Ayak, you know, gets wind of all this. You know, I've got to stop Ursus because he is my nemesis. He could come back and, you know, usurp me, even though I usurped his dad. I'm scratching my eye here. And so one of the slave ladies that was sold, you know, tries to win favor of Ayak by saying, hey, this is where we saw Ursus. He pulled me, my cat, you know, wagon out of a hole. And if you go there, he lives with lions and you should poison them. And that's what they do. Ayak sends his men. He sends Lothar, which is the second command. And they go off to capture Ursus. And they do, surprisingly, even though he puts up a good fight. But, you know, let's be honest, Ursus should have won. But, you know, once they kidnapped his lady and put her in quicksand and said, hey, it's either you or your lady gets it with the quicksand death, he gave up. Which, you know, he's normal like that. So he is now mm-hmm. captured. You know, Ayak has plans for him. He actually wants his lady to himself because, as all evil dictators want, you know, other people's ladies. And so eventually Ursus is freed by, her name's Dyar. She's one of the slave ladies who's kind of cunning, but she's not good cunning. She thinks she's really cunning, but she's really not. I mean, she kind of overtly betrays everyone and gets her comeuppance. And it's kind of one of those forehead slap moments of, you're not very good at this whole political intrigue thing you're trying to do. Well, anyway, Ursus meets up with, you know, his followers, you know, people who owe allegiance to, you know, his mom and dad, and he's going to lead them to victory. Well, that doesn't quite work out because Ayak sends his men and takes them all prisoner.
Okay.
You know, now that I'm rehashing this plot, what I'm trying to say is I actually like this film, but now that I say everything out loud, I'm like, man, there's a lot of dumb going on in it. And I mean that affectionately, but...
Of course.
So Ursus, you know, evades capture yet again, and he runs to the arena to save all his followers and save his lady, and he does. You know, he has his lion companion with him who takes out the evil Ayak, and everyone lives happily ever after, and that's... You know, it's a little cliche in a nutshell, but I liked it. It was a fun film, and as I was watching it, mentally taking notes, there's a lot of very interesting stuff going on in this film. Once you get past kind of some of the leap in logic on some of this stuff here, as is typical for not just Peplum films, but for a lot of Italian dub genre cinema.
So living with lions, not only did he have a coiffed haircut, but I'm sure he had a loincloth and a wrestler's belt and sandals and other.
He has all of that. And of course, so here's one of those leaps in logic. You know, how does he even know how to speak English and know what words mean? Because there's some sequence he's like, I don't know what money is. I don't know what the value of something is. But in the next scene, he's like, oh, yeah, I totally learned all the words I knew by hanging out by caravans that traveled through the area. So I can't help but think some of it is yeah, there's some knowledge gaps there in his education, which, come on, if you're raised by lions and you only learn a couple words from traveling caravan people, it's probably not the greatest. But I can't help but feeling that there's a little bit of winking and nodding that Ursus is kind of playing with us. Because he's kind of a tease. When he takes Anya for himself and he's kind of giggly about it, I can't help. He has a facade going on. He actually knows what money is. I mean, he doesn't know what his necklace is, but he knows what a value is. He knows what commerce is. So I can't help but, you know, some of it is the facade of being a well-coiffed muscle man that maybe there's something a little bit more to him. But on the other hand, and I'll get to a quote here in a second, which kind of challenges that. But so observations about the film. One, there's a scene where Ursus, he's in chains. He's in prison, and he's chained, and his arms are outstretched, and it's recreating that iconic image of Steve Reeves as Hercules from Hercules 1959, or 58, depending on what year you go by.
Right.
Which is a nice, you know, throwback to, you know, on this iconic scenes in Peplum films. But here's the difference between the two scenes is Hercules, you know, is able to use his strength and he tugs those chains and brings down the pillars. Ursus can't do that. He actually has to wait to be freed by Dyar, who comes through a secret passageway and then loosens the chains for him to get out. So it's kind of interesting. I guess if you're going to say, hey, who'd win in a fight, Hercules or Ursus, you know, based on that scene, I'm sorry, Ursus, you're going down. As a sword and sandal film, though, Ursus doesn't use any melee weapons. You know, he's truly a fisticuffs person. Now a lot of, you know, sword and sandal films can be divided into a lot of different, you know, ways. And some of it is, does the hero use sword or not? If it's a strong man, you know, typically the weapon they use is, you know, a club or a spear or a sword. And all of it is if you go by what Michael Cornelius says in Muscles of Men, is all it is an extension of his muscles. At some point, he's going to lose that sword anyway and fight with his fists. Well, Ursus doesn't even have to get to that point. He's already there. He doesn't even need a sword. The closest he comes to any sort of melee weapons is, you know, he throws tables at folks, which kind of reminds me of some bar scenes we saw in another Peplum film, and I'm all of a sudden drawing a blank on it.
Was that like Samson's Mighty Challenge, where the Ursus in the air was throwing stuff around, or?
No, different film, but I'll come back to it. But yeah, so sword and sandal film, Sans the sword, all his opponents have swords, but none of that stops Ursus. And it's kind of funny that, you know, even though he's like punching a lot of folks, he doesn't really overtly kill anyone on screen. I think there's some throwaway dialogue saying, he killed three of my men, but this is a pretty cartoonish violence Peplum film. It's not gory. It's not bloody. It's, you know, the character of Lothar gets his comeuppance by Ursus, this heaving him into a hole that's going to go into a pit of hyenas. And, you know, that occurs off screen. And, you know, again, it's kind of comical. Side note, the character that plays Lothar, I can't remember the actor's name, but he played in a movie called Kaltiki. He's the main antagonist in Kaltiki. And so Michelle and I, we had just watched that movie last weekend for our podcast. And so when we're watching the guy, like, that guy's familiar. We've seen him in, IMDb, that's Kaltiki. So Ursus, raised by tigers in this movie, which the various plot synopsises I read, you know, they equate it to Tarzan. And I get that, but I think it's a bit more deep than that. I actually equate it to the legend of Romulus and Remus, where, you know, that's the story of twins, but, you know, take away one twin, what do you have? You have just one baby. And same circumstances, you know, those are the twins that are, you know, their parents are killed, they're hidden away, and, you know, nursed back to health by Roma, the she-wolf. And then, of course, you know, they later go on to, you know, get, you know, vengeance against people that wronged them and find the city of Rome. And, you know, Ursus's journey is very similar to either Romus or Remus. We're going to say Romus because Remus dies by Romus, so that's not exactly okay. The best ending for Ursus. But, I mean, I see the Tarzan angle, you know, replace tigers with apes and gorillas, but I think there's a little bit of Romus in Remus there. And a side note, this plot device also, you know, fleeing, you know, your parents are dead, the kingdom is under attack, you got to get out of the city, you're raised by animals. It also happens in episode 4 of season 1 of Blood of Zeus. Exact same scenario.
I'm still waiting for that to come out in DPD. Thank you for turning me on to that.
I hope it does, but I have the strangest feeling it might just be a digital-only show. But I do hope. I mean, it's only 8 episodes. Michelle, did they ever release Castlevania as a physical release, or did they keep that digital-only? Because I know you watched the Castlevania stuff.
Yeah, I watched the first season, and I'll look at Amazon real quick. I don't know if they did a physical release, so I'll do a quick look here.
Yeah, Hercules, we're definitely entering that era of physical releases are starting to become more sporadic and more relegated to boutique publishers, Criterion, you know.
Okay.
Oh, I see Castlevania Season 2 DVD, so that's a good sign.
Yep. So it is available.
So cross fingers, Hercules, that Blood of Zeus will be a Blu-ray or a DVD.
Fingers crossed, and I'm amazed at how enlightened these lions were to send their adopted human child to receive an education from traveling caravan people, make sure he was clean, had clothes, got his hair cut. So those lions must have been quite remarkable.
The it's funny, the lion scenes are kind of awkward to watch because I don't think Fury was in those scenes. I think he's edited to be in those scenes because when you watch them, all the scenes that show Ed Fury's face, you see him close up, but all the scenes with him interacting with the lions are wide angle shot and his back is to you. And so I'm thinking trainer, because they're not going to let your star go and, you know, no matter how tame those lions are, you know, you're going to be handling them with a trainer, not your main actor. And that's, you know, if there's any, like, bad thing about this film is that it's a very animal-centric film. And we let's, you know, be honest. You know, Italian filmmaking is not like American productions. You know, animals were probably harmed on the set of these films. And I don't like to think of that. It's a little sad, but I try not to. But I think that's probably the only, you know, crappy thing about this film is, hey, there's elephants, let's push them over. Hey, there's these lions, let's, you know, grab their tails. Hey, there's these hyenas, let's pick them up and throw them around. And that's just something that Italians did in their films, all the way from the Mondo films to the cannibal films. But anyway, side note, the ending of Ursus in the Valley Alliance is a lot like Revolt of the Slaves. That movie has a secret, you know, splinter group of Christians that get rounded up and thrown in an arena, and they're all tossed to be burned. And that's the exact same thing that happens in this film, where, you know, they're not Christians. They're, you know, supporters of the true, you know, heir of this kingdom. But, you know, they get rounded up, thrown into arena. They're put onto chains, dragged by elephants to be burned. And so very, very similar ending between Revolt of the Slaves and Ursus.
Which came first, you know?
You know what? I know Ursus is 1961. Do you want to take a look at Revolt of the Slaves real quick?
Sure.
My gut tells me Ursus came first, but, you know, there's that heyday. Seriously, like 1959 to 1965, you know. Hope for the Slave, that's not. Oh, for the movie, no? That's Voltron. We'll look it up here in a second.
Okay.
Okay, so what else is going on here? The one thing I don't buy into in the film is the lion's getting poisoned. One of the plot devices is the evil tyrant comes with poisoned meat, and he throws it into the lions, and they eat it, and they supposedly die. 1960! Okay, Revolt of the Slaves beat it by 1 year.
Okay.
And the synopsis I read online and also in the Peplum books, you know, say that the lions died, which is sad, but died in the film, not in real life. But, you know, when I watch the film, you know, when Ursus goes to comfort them all, they're all just laying there and they look sleepy. To me, you know, lions aren't dumb. You know, they have a sense of smell. They can smell when, you know, their meats and stuff are probably, hey, I shouldn't be eating this. You know, and these are probably very well-kept lions. I mean, they've got Ursus there to set traps to capture antelopes and stuff for him. So I'm going to go with those lions did not die. They just got tranquilized by some drug or something, and they're up and running. But that's just my kind of take on it. kind of passage I do want to read. This is from Of Muscles and Men, Michael G. Cornelius. And it talks about the role of the strong men in all these films. And it, after reading this package, it got me thinking, what is Ursus's role in this film? And so this is from page 7. It's a great book. He says, Gunsberg rightly argues, though, not because of its parodic or excessive nature, but because of the functionality of the strong man's muscles themselves. Herbert Schenck labels Peplum heroes as saviors, but they are saviors not because of their innate, overdeveloped sense of right and wrong, but because of their singular muscularity functions, in many ways for no other real distinct purpose. That is, they must act when no one else can, not because it's the right thing to do, or to be fair about it, not just because it is the right thing to do, but because they're the only individuals who possess the means to do so. And so it kind of got me thinking, what is Ursus's morality in this story? Because through the course of the film, his goals change. And I don't know if it's, you know, if he's just adapting as the narrative goes, or this kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier with this well-coiffed Terran, you know, learning language from the caravans. How much of it is a facade? Because beginning of the film, he has no goal. His goal is... If anything, he gets his girl at the very beginning, and he just wants to have a good life with her. So he already accomplishes that by yanking her out of the caravan. Well, as soon as she becomes kidnapped, that's his goal. I want to free her. I don't care about anything else. As soon as he's captured and brought before Aak, and Aak's like, oh, yeah, I killed your father, and, you know, this is my kingdom, then Ursus drops, you know, wanting to save his lady. He's like, well, I'm going to kill you. I want vengeance. And then once he becomes free and he's with the sectionists, he drops that then. He overtly says, I have one reason and one reason only to come here, and that was to free you people and give you back your lands, which seems like a very monarchical or at least political thing to say.
Uh-huh.
So it's funny that, you know, his compass of what's right and wrong or what he wants to do, it changes with the narrative, and it's kind of idiosyncratic. But at the end of the day, it fits in with the quote. He is the only one that can do it. You can argue and say that he's the only one that can do it because he's the rightful heir by blood, but let's just be honest, it's because he's a strong guy who was raised by lions and who can, you know, fisticuff his way out of Aeox's dungeon and through his men.
That's something definitely to ponder, and you could apply that statement to Conan in the movies also. You know, Conan does not really have a moral compass that most people would ascribe to, but he's the only one who can do it, and he does it.
It's so funny you say that, Hercules, because the quote I read from Of Muscles and Men, the example they give, the very next sentence is about Conan. It says, when Conan destroys the evil cult leader Thulsa Doom, he acts not for any greater good, but out of revenge.
Right.
So, anyway, I see where we got 5 minutes left, but those are kind of my musings on Ursus. I think this is definitely a, I mean, I'm watching the alpha video cut of this film, which is an affront to all the, this is a side note, because I brought up earlier, we watched Kalpiki, which was made 2 years earlier, and the film is just gorgeous. And here we have this film, I think was shot black and white, but it's been so degraded, it's just blurry, it's a terrible pan and scan, and it's just, man, just to watch a film like this on the big screen back in the, you know, early 60s would have been quite the treat. And that's,
yeah,
and I brought this up times, the preservation of these films is so horrid, but I liked it. I liked Ursus. It was lighthearted. It was an adventurous, cartoonish, violent peplum film that, he's a good hero, I think. He's an inconsistent hero, but he's a likable hero with his wool-coiffed hair.
Is it called by any other names? Because peplum films are notorious for having like a bunch of different names. And as you pointed out, the hero is not the same hero. So he could be Samson, it could be Ursus, it could be Machiste, it could be Hercules, you know, it could be Atlas. Is there another name attached to the film?
I think there's like a shorter name just called like Valley of Fire or something. But as far as I know, I don't think this film has been re-edited and redubbed into a Hercules film. I know some other Ursus films have, but I think this one's been more or less consistent Ursus Valley of Fire.
Hercules film? I think it was, I think I'm not positive, but I seem to remember that Valley of Fire was, released as a Sons of Hercules film as well.
Yeah, I think that's Valley of Fire, while this is Valley of One. It's funny because the Alpha video release has both films on it, Valley of Fire on one and Lions on the other. Oh, here it is. Alternate titles, according to Wikipedia, Valley of Lions and also Son of Atlas in the Valley of Lions. So Son of Atlas. Anyway, highly recommend it. I'll see if I can parlay this along with some other feline Pepla films into an abstract, and maybe I'll actually be working on an essay to see, you know, the depiction of cats in old sword and sandal films. Wish me luck.
And can you do modern things also? I wish you great luck in everything you do.
Yeah.
He-Man has Battle Cat. Or you know, Prince Adam as Cringer, I guess that would fit in not with classical peplum films, but if you made it broader to include the new peplum, there's another one.
You know, I was thinking of new peplum just because the both of the Hercules films, you know, Hercules at the Rock and also Legend of Hercules, are the only films I can find that he actually battles the Nemean lion. I mean, come on, that's like the progenitor of all this.
Right. And we're down to our last minute, and I'd love it if you guys can share your contact information, because you're awesome people, you're phenomenally creative, and you produce really awesome collections, and I like your fiction too, The Cats of Ulthar. And if you're going to write a fiction story, you could sneak them in with The Muscle Man.
So, Hercules, people can find me on my website. It's just michellebrittany.com. But I only occasionally go there at the moment. You can find me on Facebook. I have a public page. It's Michelle Brittany, as well as Amazon. I do have an author page with all the books that I'm involved in. We also have a separate podcast called HP Lovecast. So you can also find me over there. We have a page for that.
I'm at nickdiak.com, NICKDIAK.com. From there, there's links to all my social medias. I do a weekly roundup of not just personal news, but peplum news as well.
Thank you so very much. I wish you great success in all your endeavors. And this month is a treat. We'll be together in next week. So until then, thank you very much. Thanks to everybody for joining us. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Bye-bye. Thanks again.